This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb. Our third host, Donna Colby, is away. So you're just going to have to listen to Alan and I go way out there in our heads without that that grounding force of Donna this time.
We've actually been waiting for a chance to go completely off the wall with a program
or two. Let's hope she doesn't listen. We were talking about immersion in a field such that you can't, it's hard to see the field, which actually describes life itself. I brought it up because I'm going to be giving a course for one of the local companies here in town on fine art to try to define, help the staff there kind of get a handle on what fine art is. But that's a very nebulous thing. It's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is. So all I can do is sort of point it out by using slides and pictures and talk about properties that are universal in all great works of art. But it's more like you can feel it when you're moved by a piece of art in a museum. That's got it, and other commercial things that you see on the television perhaps don't have it. But you can see it more easily from a distance, from 5 years, 10 years, 20, 100 years away. So we can look back in the history of art, and obviously there's these peaks, and there's these unifying qualities, qualities of unity and wholeness, and the sum is greater than the parts, and all these things that we see about the great works of art. But when we're in a period like we are right now, in the contemporary period, making art and looking at things, it's not as easy to actually see it. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of areas, a lot of examples in life where, because we are immersed in something, we have no perspective on it. Even the language we use to talk about the situation is visual and really pretty self-explanatory. You can't see the forest for the trees because you're immersed in the forest. You have no perspective because you're not far enough away from it to see it as a thing. So there's something about seeing things, I guess, out of context that really is what affords the opportunity to classify it. And in a sense, that's a really key concept because, as I've discussed before, I think on some of our programs where we talked about sound, we are actually immersed in a sea of sound. There's sound coming at us from dozens and dozens of sources all the time. And yet we don't go through life thinking, wow, I'm swimming in a sea of sound. We just hear occasional things. And yet in between those occasional things, there's a constant signal of, you know, constant mix of signals from all sorts of things, creaking furniture and flapping things and leaves outside and cars going by and horns and the sounds of our own metabolism pumping the blood around and things. But we don't pick up on those things. And yet if you record them and play them back in a different context, you very easily notice them. In fact, when you're recording the soundtrack for a movie, one of the things that you always do is record what they call room tone. At the end of each shot, there was an ambient sound that everyone was completely oblivious to, and that ambient sound has to be available to the sound processing people in post-production so that they can make a scene flow into the next scene without abrupt changes in sound. And when you play that room tone back, you can hear tremendous differences between one shot and another shot. The camera's in a different place and the environment has changed and there are different bugs buzzing or different, you're closer to the air conditioner or whatever it is. And so that seems to be a central element in the process of discrimination. Being able to tell something apart from something else is, it's actually hugely fundamental to the actual workings of the human mind. You know, you can't name something until you have differentiated it from everything else. And it's the separation of one thing from the background, the foreground from the background, that allows you to even know it exists, much less name it, and then remember it and recognize it.
But there's a kind of selection taking place.
Oh, yeah.
That's choosing which things to compare.
Right.
And that's what's very interesting, because we can place the attention where we want.
Right.
And that's what the artist does, basically, is he starts making people look at things that they're not normally looking at.
Yeah, I think in a way you could say that that's entirely what art is. That's why there's something new under the sun, even though in another sense there isn't anything new under the sun. It's the juxtaposition that makes it something. Just as we've said many times before, the act of displaying it in the gallery, which causes people to take a look at it, whereas if it were just lying on the street and they were stepping on it, they probably wouldn't take a look at it. And there are plenty of things that we would walk right over that if we took a good look at them, we'd find them really fascinating.
And yet it's impossible to take it all in at once. The selection is necessary to function.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We would be, drowned in sight and sound otherwise.
And then you can start to see how we have two human awarenesses walking next to each other, or 10 or 100 or 10,000, and they're all seeing different realities.
Right, right.
And then we have the Democratic point of view and the Republican point of view.
Well, and it all ties back to the process of discriminating, and not just the notion of being discriminating, but the actual ability to perceive something. We've all heard a million times the concept that the Eskimos have 50 words for snow. And that means they have noticed 50 different kinds of snow. So they can talk about them. If we don't have those words, we can't talk about them. And we don't have much vocabulary for talking about the ambient sound qualities of the environment that we're in. We don't have a list of words for room tone, in other words. So it's something nobody ever talks about. And when you experience bad acoustics, you don't go away saying, boy, that room was really tubby and boomy and had really terrible, acoustics. You just go away dissatisfied with the experience. And yet it applies in every area, but differentiating what we consider to be fine art or great art from all the other creative expression that we're immersed in. Is a tricky business, and it's a culturally defined thing. There are things that were considered great art in the Renaissance that are no longer considered to be particularly worthy. And each age, I'm sure, has examples of things that were really hot and have just not withstood the test of time. And yet they might come back another 50 years from now.
What I find, in a contemporary period, there's often like the trends of the moment,
right,
which are driven by so many things, where the attention is being manipulated for various reasons.
Right.
And then I'm just trying to get at this thing of that there seems to be something that rises to the top over time, and there's a consistent beauty, we might say, that's in those pieces, and that seems to transcend trendiness.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's
and those can go out of fashion too,
right?
Because a trend can take over a kind of universal beauty,
right?
So it's all very interesting.
Right. Well, I think that you know, there is something about art that, or let's just call it creative expression, that which contains some depth of awareness, some depth of understanding, some depth of skill and craftsmanship and things like that. That's really what people begin to differentiate when they refine their own ability to perceive this stuff. And that may or may not be supported by the current trends, so there will be some waxing and waning of that over the years. But still, if you see the work of an artisan from 1,000 years ago who was good at what he did, you recognize that. You can tell it's really something worth taking a second look at. And it's got nothing to do with trends and nothing to do with anything except that, I guess, the basic notion that we do value depth and skill and knowledge and understanding. But God help us if we didn't. I mean, that's really pretty basic. If you don't value that, then what do you value? So, well, theoretically, yeah, we might not, but in practice, civilization would be on the way out if we didn't.
Well, it shows that we're driven by fairly shallow motivations.
Yeah.
In the short term,
right?
Maybe we will, and that shows that we will often compromise these, because we're sort of tuning in to kind of deep universal truths. Mm-hmm. As we look back. But in the moment, we find that we're constantly compromising left and right. for expediency and all of these concerns that we have. And those things drop away mm-hmm. with time. And then there are sort of like, just as there are certain principles and truths that inform every religion, no matter how much people are going to war today over their religion, there are certain that there's a kind of truth that has given each one its power in the beginning.
Right. Well, it reminds me of the function of memory, which really began to strike me as a fascinating phenomenon once I, you know, got into my 30s, I guess it was. I suddenly realized I was remembering things that were 20, 25 years ago, and I thought, wow, that's kind of amazing. You know, I'm really... I had been able to remember something that far away before because I wasn't old enough. And then I began to notice that these memories had sort of a strange idealized quality about them, and I wondered where that came from. And I think where it comes from is this phenomenon, which in audio and or in signal processing in general would be called common mode rejection. And the idea is that if you have a signal on a background of noise, the signal has some coherence to it, some pattern. The background is incoherent, it's random. And so if you have three or four examples of that signal against a random background, if you add them together, the coherent signal waves tend to add up, and the signal gets louder and louder. And the random background bits just randomly add up. So they mostly add or cancel at random. So they tend not to change much. So the signal-to-noise ratio gets better and better and better as you add more and more layers. And that's kind of what we're doing with memory. And I think that's kind of what we're doing when we look at the creative expressions of a society from the past. We've seen those things many times now in many contexts, and what they have in common from different artists with saying different things, what they have in common gets amplified, and what's completely unrelated among them gets gradually lost in the noise. So you see trends of the past that are clear and are not currently changing anymore. Whereas you can't see trends in the present because they are currently changing and there isn't any of this common mode rejection. You don't get to look at them 20 times.
Right, that's very interesting. So what we're actually beginning to locate the archetypal human intelligence.
Yeah.
That's emerging. It's the one intelligence that's our intelligence and what we are.
Yeah, yeah. the humanness.
Because there is this, like, yes, and I know, we all know that's that's true. That could be a mark that we could say is something about every great work of art. And it begins to more and more transcend the period and the style and the time.
Right. It's really a very good kind of cultural analogy to common mode, you know, noise elimination. It's very interesting. I mean, people are... You can now do it very easily in Photoshop. It's a great example of it in a whole different area. If you take a photograph of the Fairfield Town Square and you think to yourself, boy, that would be a much nicer photograph if there weren't any cars driving by, because they're a little blurry and they're not really part of the composition. If your camera's on the tripod and you take, say, six or eight pictures, one after another, and the cars are all in different positions during those pictures, then you can stack those things up in Photoshop and tell it to eliminate what's not present in all the pictures. And you end up with the town square with no traffic, absolutely none, even though that never occurred, you know, on that particular day anyway. And that's really, in a sense, what's happening. I think all of our human perception is kind of mediated by that process of the common things getting amplified just by the nature of perceiving a pattern, perceiving anything. It's a given in the actual process of sensory perception. So the more you look at things, the more the things they have in common come to the foreground. It makes you wonder if there are things that are unique every now and then that could be really, really important and never get seen.
Right.
Because if you look back at them and there's nothing overlaying them to amplify them, they're gone.
Right. And that's why there's all, we are told that there's all this stuff going on that we can't see,
yeah,
and that some people do see.
Yeah, maybe it's just because
can it can be revealed.
And, yeah.
And artists tend to be the ones that explore those territories, beyond the general way of seeing. They lock themselves in their studio and they take a little bit of dive into an aspect of it.
Yeah.
And then they bring it back for everybody else. But if an art, and well, we know that in art history, things get lost. Mm-hmm. And then there's a revival. 200 years later, 1,000 years later, somebody's attention goes there. And then human awareness as a group human awareness is brought to that again.
Yeah. And you suddenly realize that artist actually was 100 years ahead of his time doing something that no one else was doing. And so it wasn't really perceptible until generations later when other people began doing a similar thing. And then because of that overlay, it suddenly became visible.
But I think it's what all creative people and all great reformers and leaders are doing,
mm-hmm.
and those around whom religions are created.
Yeah.
They're looping attention back onto some essential truth that got out of the line of vision.
Yeah, it kind of says something about the advisability of sticking to one particular viewpoint, because the wisdom of perspective that you get from looking at something over the long course of time gets canceled out if you don't look at it that way. If you insist on looking at it one way, then you're just actually not looking at reality anymore. You're looking at something that you decided, but the new input isn't having an effect on your thinking or behavior.
And that's generally a kind of a conservative way of looking at things, that because there's safety in that. The other is fraught with uncertainty.
Right. Yeah, it's conservative in the sense of being conservative about the field of possibilities. It doesn't have anything to do with being conservative about, you know, finances or a less risk-oriented approach to government or something. It's a way of thinking that's conservative, which I think is nowadays being confused with the political angle of being conservative. They're becoming conservative mentally instead of conservative fiscally and politically. They're good argument. I mean, I'm a constitutional conservative and I'm a fiscal conservative. I think we should be really careful about changing the Constitution. And I think we should be really careful about how we spend our money. And that, to me, means I am conservative in those areas. But at the same time, in order to be careful, you have to look at the options. And if you're dogmatic, then you, instead of looking at the options, you're just sticking to some idea that came up. And very few ideas come up that stand the test of time. If you look back at history, the things you can still see are the things that stood the test of time. People talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, and I've always found that kind of fascinating, because I don't think the Roman Empire fell. What happened was Rome simply got digested by Europe, and it's in there in all the European languages, and it's in the European culture, and it's a part of the flow of human civilization. It's not as though one day, you know, the last emperor had his thing and then there wasn't anything left. What was left was a vast culture that had its fingers in everything all over the European subcontinent. And the Roman soldiers who were in Britain stayed in Britain and became British. They didn't just disappear off the face of the earth because the Roman Empire had fallen. And when we look back at all of that, that's really what we see is the whatever was still part of the Roman style of doing things that has survived. It's there because we see it over and over and over again, and it's been repeated for generations, and certain aspects of the way they did things are still there. Including the way they used numbers.
But in many ways, when I go, this is a little bit of an aside, but when I go to the museums and I see Roman faces, and mm-hmm. I see the Roman senators, the statues, and they have all this Roman stuff, that it feels very American.
Yeah, it does. Know? It looks very familiar.
It's like with our way of government and our kind of business and all this, it seems like Rome is still quite alive in American culture.
Yeah. Well, it's a central vein in the history of European culture. And as diverse as European culture is, it's still all recognizably European. And it's this, you know, expansion approach to civilization that's based on commerce and acquisition of land and territory and stuff. And, you know, we had a whole sequence of European empires that were trying to get themselves established around the world. And not obviously not only Europeans did that, you know, the Mongols did it quite nicely for a while, and it seems like it's one of the things that civilizations do while they're learning how to be human. And then at some point, one hopes they grow out of that. Civilizations full of first-timers. Mm-hmm. So differentiating fine art from other art is really a delicate question. We've got...
Well, yeah, I'm working on how to approach this thing for this course I'm doing. And one thing that popped up, which I might actually use, I don't know if I'll use it or not, but sometimes it's very... By showing something that's definitely not it, it reveals more it.
Yes.
And so I think in this, the introduction to this thing, I'm going to show a Raphael Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ran across, I don't know what, I have to figure out what this is and where it came from, but it just sort of popped up on Google Images. There's a picture of Angelina Jolie with her three babies in heaven, in the sky, like a Raphael, with like strip malls and stuff below.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it's a fun and contemporary statement, but it's obviously not fine art.
Yeah.
And the other obviously is fine art. And just by comparing those two images, it's you see that the one is not... The technique of painting is adequate to get the message across, which is a contemporary message. It's not a universal message at all.
Right.
While the Madonna and Child is a universal statement, a universal metaphor,
right.
And the paint has been applied with the most delicate of emotions and love and feeling.
Yeah.
And the other, it's just to get this sort of like cultural, you know, contemporary cultural statement across. So it's sort of, I found that that's one way to sort of like frame the fine art, is to set it against everything else, and it's obvious.
Yeah. And yet, that's not to say that the contemporary expression, which is just for a social comment, is any less valid. It simply has a different scope.
Right, and this is interesting, too. It's, you know, when we're talking about fine art, we're talking about this thing that takes you to this deepest level. It doesn't make the other less valid because it does, because it has its role today for a moment. It's like a poof, for a moment it did its thing.
Yeah.
The other seems to be like live on for ages.
Right. Right.
And reiterate the what's available to life.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.